As you know, side has 15 minutes to argue.
Yes, sir.
Would you like to reserve a portion of your 15 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, 5 minutes, sir. Thank you.
You have it. You may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, justices. My name is Attorney Jeroy Green. I'm here representing Ulysses Blanding Jr. in this matter. What we're contending, Your Honor, justices, I'm
your
sorry.
Your client testified that the victim stabbed herself 35 times.
That was one of the things he testified to, yes, sir.
The victim stabbed herself 35 times, including defensive things, wounds on her arms, and then stuck a knife 5 inches into it to kill herself. That was his testimony, wasn't it?
Not that she stuck the knife in the cutter, the killer self, Judge. Judge, if I recall correctly, I think he said, my client stated, he testified that she was stabbing and cutting herself.
Well, she was stabbed 35 times.
Yes, sir. That was what the forensic evidence showed. But at the same time, the forensic evidence also showed the fact that he had defensive cuts. Cuts on his palm, cut on the ear, mm-hmm. cut across the chest.
But he couldn't remember anything on cross, could he? Couldn't remember about a whole lot of things. Is that right?
No, sir. He remembered some things, and up to a certain point, he stated he cannot remember any more. And that was what brings us before the court.
He had a proper testimony. Was this psychiatrist? Was he an expert in? I believe the trial court asked this question. Is he a memory expert?
No, sir. He was not a memory expert. He was an expert proffered for the purpose of testifying with regard to dissociative amnesia and the effects that it may have. And as the court declared...
But he had already testified, had he not?
No, sir.
I thought he had already testified in the trial before this proffered testimony.
He did, Judge.
Let's correct that then.
Yes.
He had already testified.
Correct.
Had he not?
Yes, he did.
And I gather his testimony was about sanity at the time of the offense. Is that what his
correct?
That was his testimony.
Yes, sir.
So you wanted to recall him so that he could say that, this is why he can't remember certain stuff on cross-examination.
No, sir. Well, I will tell the courts that I was not trial counsel at the time.
Well, I want to say that. We have a great deal of sympathy for someone in your position.
Yes, sir.
You know, it's like that old country saying, you know, you got to dance with the one that brung you.
Yes. So
you didn't bring this.
But I'm ready to dance. But I am ready to dance, Your Honor. And what I would say with regards to that is that when the expert was proffered the second time for testimony, it was not with regards to the insanity at the time of the defense. It was with regards to the fact that the court made such a fact and a significance on the fact that my client could not remember certain portions of what occurred. And I would tell the court that it was even to the point where the court characterized it as convenient lapse of memory with regard to my client not being able to remember certain portions of that.
The offer was he was going to show that he suffered from dissociative amnesia, quote, which is essentially the inability to remember certain events after a traumatic event.
Yes, sir.
It would relate to all people having been in a traumatic event.
Correct.
And the trial court said, well, the officer is an expert on memory, and I'm not letting him in. But as I understand the proffer, assuming it was error, the proffer was, hey, gee, when people go through a traumatic event, they can't remember what happened. But that's not exactly what your client testified to, was it?
No, sir.
He could remember some things, but not other things.
Well, I will tell the court that based on my client's testimony, he was very candid with regards to what he could not remember and what he could remember. And I even remember reviewing the transcript and kind of bowing my head when he said, well, I had the knife, and so I must have cut her then. So, you know, him making that statement after stating that he could not remember certain things. Now, I would ask the court to kind of reflect back on the record. He remembers certain things up to a certain point.
He said, I have the knife and I guess I cover it. What does that do to the, with respect to whether the error, if there was an error, in not forbidding this testimony, whether it's harmless or not?
Well, Judge, we have to determine if it's a constitutional error. There's a different test.
Did it claim it was constitutional error?
It was not.
So
it was not.
What about non-constitutional error here?
Well, then there's a different analysis, Judge.
Yeah,
Yes. Well, harmless error in terms of constitutional error is still analyzed, but it's analyzed in a different manner.
Yes, sir.
With regards to harmless error, when it's non-constitutional, there's case law, and there's also the Code of Virginia also speaks to that as well. But one of the things that's most glaring is in this situation, it's a bench trial, and often in jury trials, in this type of situation, a jury trial was not taken. That you're not able to see into the mind of the jurors when they're contemplating the evidence and reaching their conclusions and deducing the evidence that's placed before them. So in this situation, we have a bench trial.
Yeah.
And the judge is actually providing statements that let us look into his mind as he's deducing the evidence and then making a decision with regards to the verdict.
Well, the judge must have had in his mind what the proffer was, didn't he? He had to.
Well, I can't say that because I don't purport to be able to read or know what was in his mind at the time. We know he heard it.
Well, he heard the proffer.
Yes, but see, okay, so what I would respectfully disagree with Your Honor is that he heard it, but there's nothing in the record that says that he reflects back to that proffer. So we don't know if he disregarded it in whole or in part, or, you know, what weight did he give it at all? We know that the court did say certain things at the arrival of the verdict and then at sentencing as well when the motion to set aside the verdict was placed. And specifically, the court will grant me this opportunity with regards to the verdict on page 110 of the record of the joint appendix. He said at line one, quote, he gave no such explanation to the police with the testimony he had today, and his inconsistent testimony today shed great light on his intent, and he conveniently has a gap in his memory when this woman is basically slashed and stabbed. Then he goes down to line 15 on the same page. Here you have a gap where the man goes blank, and then he gets on the stand after giving the story to the police that the woman had inflicted all these self-wounds and says, and I'm ending that part there, and then on page 119 of the joint appendix, starting at line 23, this is in the court's response to the motion to set aside the verdict. The defendant took the stand and he has very convenient memories, about when he gets to the critical part of the mass stabbing. He forgets the more critical aspect of it, but he testified that he got the knife away from her at one point and then he doesn't remember anything after that and she's got multiple stab wounds. So the court does not find in its previous decision, it's erroneous and overrules the motion to set aside the verdict. So,
not guilty, the court's going to have to conclude that this woman stabbed herself 35 times. I mean, there's no question your client was there. There's no
correct
about that. So the court would have to conclude that if your client wasn't the person who stabbed her, she must have stabbed herself 35 times.
Well, I will also tell the court that the record showed, the evidence was, there was one fatal stab. One stabbing was fatal.
Okay.
The others, and I don't recall specifically, and I apologize, the depth and the length of each of the stab wounds, the penetration depth of them, where they occurred. I did see the trial file, but that's not part of the record. But I will tell the court that with regards to the fact that this individual candidly states on the stand, testifying in his own behalf, that he remembers things up to a certain point, but then forgets. The court opines verbally out loud that it's convenient for him to forget and that he has this sudden lapse and convenient lapse of memory when we get to the, for lack of a better phrase, salient point of his testimony.
Does he do this in front of the fact finder? Is this a jury trial?
No, Judge. This is a bench trial.
Okay.
So what I've just read and everything that I read before your honors is the statements of the court making to the defense counsel regarding the finding of the verdict, and then two, the motion to set aside the verdict after the finding of the verdict of guilt of first-degree murder. So we're able to see into the judge's mind, his thought process, not 100% into his thought process, but what was significant enough for him.
Along with the judge saying, I mean, Judge Alston and I spent, I guess, between his 30 years as trial court judges. What's wrong at a judge trial with a judge commenting, boy, that's a selective memory? Something wrong with that?
Well, there is nothing wrong with that, but what it does, what I think it differs is, whereas with a jury, you have to guess, and the courts are very reluctant to go into the minds of jurors and to disturb their findings.
That's right.
But what I would say in this instance, Your Honor, is that we have a situation where the judge, my client took the stand, his credibility is paramount in terms of the statements that he makes. It's apparent from the record and from the judge's statements that credibility, the judge made one statement regarding the forensic evidence. It was a very brief blurb on what the forensic evidence showed. Okay, the rest of his comments were based on the fact that my client took the stand, made statements, testified, but then at certain points during cross-examination conveniently forgot the facts that were salient or answers to the questions that were being posed to him on cross-examination. So it's my position that the judge could have done it this way and arrived at the same point. He could have allowed Per Pritchett, which was the case that was alluded to in the appellee's response brief, he could have allowed the expert to testify in general about a subject in which the judge was unfamiliar with. We know that because there's nothing in the record that said the judge was familiar with dissociative amnesia. Okay, he could have allowed to testify in general. Dissociative amnesia is this. These are the characteristics of it. These are the symptoms of it.
Pritchett work against you because the important holding of Pritchett is an expert witness may testify about an area of expertise that is not within the range of the common experience of the fact finder, so you're okay there. But an expert, quote, may not express an opinion as to the veracity of a witness because such testimony improperly invades the province of the fact finder to determine the reliability of a witness. So doesn't the second part of Pritchett cut against you?
No, it doesn't, Judge, because...
Just want to let you know, please answer this question, but you're into your rebuttal.
Yes, sir. It's already been established that I have to dance with the partner I came to the dance with. But this expert would not have testified specifically with regards to Mr. Blanding's veracity or credibility on the stand as he took it. What he would testify to is that Mr. Blanding has his diagnosis. These are the symptoms that people with his diagnosis experience, which offers an explanation, a plausible explanation, for defense purposes as to why he did not conveniently forget facts that were on why he was on the stand, but this is the reason why he did forget, and it wasn't a self-serving purpose, but it was a result of a medical condition. What I would say in closing, because I want to reserve some time, is what the judge could have done was allow this expert to testify in general to educate him on what dissociative amnesia is.
Well, he could have admitted it and given it appropriate weight.
Yes, and then by not doing that, he denied my client his Sixth Amendment right to have to call and have a witness there. And that's what we're at. And so it's clear that decision, the judge's decision, was based in a large part on my client's credibility, the fact that he forgot conveniently large portions of the testimony and the facts. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Gene Murphy for the Commonwealth.
Mr. Murphy, is it harmless error here?
Well, it's unquestionably harmless error, mostly because when you're usually talking about situations where you're concerned about the credibility of a witness having been reduced, he has offered evidence that you want the fact finder to believe. Well, Mr. Blanding doesn't do that. He doesn't say anything about what happened that caused the murder. He doesn't remember it. He does say that I must have done it because I was the only one there. His only defense at trial was self-defense, but the medical examiner pointed out page 52 there were in fact 50 wounds to the victim. that could not have been self-imposed, if self-inflicted. So
evidence that this victim was Japanese and subject to Harry Perry or anything?
None of that. He committed the offense. He committed a homicide, no question about it. The question was premeditation. Well, then of course, the only issue is, well, if you have 50 wounds and you claim self-defense, for instance, well, why didn't you stop, you know, after a few? Why did you keep going? There was just too much time to premeditate, to decide this is going to be it. Of course, he fled from the scene. The victim's sister testified that she had called the witness and said, he slashed my face, I have to go to the hospital. He did that because I wouldn't give him the remote control.
Looking at this issue in the light, advantageous, I'm not saying most favorable to the defendant, but advantageous to the defendant is, in any trial that is a judge trial, there are two components of it as far as I'm concerned, because not only as a trial judge, you're making the determination on culpability, and you're also making the determination as to what is the appropriate sentence in a case. And as a trial judge, when I would make a determination as to what was the appropriate sentence in the case, after finding a person guilty, a lot of things would go into my consideration. You know, acceptance of responsibility for the crime, candor, remorse, all of those things would be important for me to make that determination. And if I'm dealing with a person who is generally predatory and has no psychological, emotional issues, which we all agree this person did have, I would probably look at him a little different than I would a person who did not have those issues. And so if I don't understand the importance of an expert witness coming in and testifying why a person might give answers that seem to make no sense, might it not go to my disposition on the aspect of the credibility of this particular witness, the defendant, what I should do with them after finding him guilty, all of those things? In other words, it gives me the full picture as to how I have to deal with this particular defendant as opposed to just, you know, as we like to say, rubber stamp justice, which we all want to avoid. Isn't that important?
Well, the judge himself, when the evidence was first presented, said this is sentencing evidence.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it could have been presented at sentencing for that purpose, but it wasn't. The question was, and I think what makes it easier in this case, it would have been very different, perhaps, if Mr. Green's interpretation of what the purpose of the evidence was what was offered by the defense counsel at trial.
Well, in addition, this psychiatrist had, in fact, already testified.
Well, I don't think he did, Your Honor. He was called. And as he began his questions, there is in the record a competency report performed by Evan Nelson.
That was adjudication as to the ability to stand trial and
right,
understand
right.
the concept.
But I don't think there's any testimony.
But there was psychiatric testimony as to his mental state. Not testimony, but documentary.
But there was a record. I mean, there is some basis for the claim of schizophrenia. But of course, you know, because it's a testimony of mental illness, it generally comes in very limited situations because we are not a diminished capacity state, so it makes no difference unless it's
so you're suggesting that your opponent colleague's argument may well carry more significant weight if, in the context of the trial, this particular evidence had been presented traditionally as sentencing evidence.
Yeah, sure. And well, the real problem is that when the defense counsel suggested to the court why this was admissible, he said, in brief, that he now states that the expert was to testify to the defendant's inability to remember due to having a dissociative amnesia. At trial, at page 94, counsel said, it goes to my client's credibility. I want him to testify as to why my client would remember certain things and not remember other things. He then said, when the judge asked for a further proffer, he said, I want to testify on what's called dissociative amnesia and why my client would remember certain portions of his testimony and why he was unable to answer the Commonwealth's questions as to why he doesn't remember. So these are exactly the things that this court said in Davison the expert cannot testify to. And in Ondorf, again, the court said that you cannot say that, well, the reason my client's behavior was kind of strange is that he has this illness. She has this illness. true that in certain situations you can have an expert testify about that the defendant has a condition, and that people in general who have that condition may have poor memory or memory problems. But you have to tell the judge that that's what you want. And I think in this case, the defendant kept saying, I want him to testify about my client. I want him to say why my client doesn't remember, and not to go the proper route. Because in Orndorff, which is generally the lead case in this area, the defendant had argued that the expert is entitled to testify that her mental illness was a basis for several inconsistencies in her behavior. And the court said, no, you can't do that. But that you could do the other approach. Now, if defense counsel had suggested that, then we might have a very different issue. But he kept saying it's credibility. I want him to testify about why my client didn't do this, not why people in general might not do it.
It goes back to the old adage, just because someone qualifies as an expert witness, that doesn't open up all kinds of areas that they can provide
absolutely
expert
yeah.
testimony
yeah,
on.
No question about it.
On that Davis case?
Davison, I have that in my brief, and I can provide that. With, I may have it right here.
Oh, I have it here.
It's 18-496 in Virginia Appeals. That's, and I mean, there are lots of other cases on that proposition that you, and I think that's, you know, Pritchard went in and said, well, you couldn't introduce it on credibility, but because here this question of a suggestible, a defendant who's suggestible and whose confession, which was before the jury for determination of whether it was voluntary, whether or not you could point out that, in fact, people who are suggestible might, in fact, testify, confess falsely. But so I think that the problem here is that the proffer doesn't satisfy the law, that you have to indicate that you would follow the proper procedure. Muhammad's error again. I mean, the selective memory is a problem also. Even if this expert had testified, he would have to explain why the defendant remember portions of these events. When he's able to explain about some of his wounds, he's able to explain how he got the gun, although he says at one point, how he got the knife. He says at one point, I don't remember how he got it, but he in fact told the police she was stabbing herself, I stopped her, I took the knife, and I got cut at that point. But he doesn't remember when he attacked her. And you would think perhaps the traumatic event would be when he's attacked. But there's just too much of that he remembers. And I don't think any expert could have explained why, in fact, this kind of selective memory would have been present.
How do you distinguish that? Let's say the argument said, well, counsel said, I want to put this guy on to show his selective memory with respect to his credibility. Is that the same thing as saying, I want to put him on to testify as to credibility?
No, Your Honor, but in fact, here the defense counsel made it clear that he wanted the expert to testify why Mr. Blanding didn't remember. He didn't say, I wanted him to testify why people in general don't remember, but I want him to testify to his truthfulness when he's in fact saying, I don't remember.
So the particularity of the proffer is what?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's it exactly. Okay. That in fact, you know, this is a procedure that is available. The defendant could have asked the court to follow that procedure. He didn't. And because we are careful to keep out testimony of mental illness, because it's not ordinarily permissible, unless there's an insanity defense presented, the courts have made that clear statement that you have to make it clear that this is not just an effort to bolster the credibility or truthfulness of the testimony, but in fact, we're going to follow the route that's been laid out in the cases. For that reason, I think, you know, if you get to the harmless error, this is unquestionably harmless error, because if the defendant had this testimony, you still would have had the fact that somebody killed this person. The defendant says, I'm the one who had to do it. There's no question about self-defense. It's impossible for the woman to have inflicted these wounds on herself. And it's too long, this claim that he didn't premeditate. So, I mean, the defendant doesn't, I mean, I say, he doesn't explain the murder. And then the court says, I don't believe your explanation because I don't believe that you have the selective memory problem. He just says, I don't know what it was. And the judge says, well, you know, you had a convenient blackout. But what is the evidence that would prove his innocence that was kept out because the judge didn't believe about his memory loss? If the judge had said, okay, you have a big memory loss, but in fact you killed this person and you stabbed her 50 times, well, why should I not convict you? And clearly here it's a harmless error. And for those reasons, we request that decision be affirmed. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr.
Martin.
Mr. Green, you have your rebuttal time.
Yes, thank you. Just to clarify, in the record, in page 93 of the joint appendix, the trial attorney said, Judge, I have it, but I think anytime you raise, the Commonwealth raises the issue of any kind of amnesia, why he doesn't remember certain events, I'm proffering that this doctor can testify as to dissociative, what's called dissociative amnesia related to PSD, post-traumatic. The court, I know it cannot be used in the course of establishing insanity defense, so tell me how it differs. Well, it goes to my client's credibility. The Commonwealth has raised an issue about my client's either selective memory or his impaired memory, and I'm proffering this witness to testify as to why my client will remember certain things and not other things. I think that clarifies the fact that the trial attorney was not offering the expert to say that his client was telling the truth or that what he was saying. He was proffering the expert to deal with the issue of credibility of his client, who was the witness, based on the fact that the court...
He was proffering the testimony to show that his client, that the defendant, was credible when he said, I don't remember.
Correct.
Isn't that a question of credibility?
It is, but that's an ultimate question of credibility that the court has at the end. But see, our position is this. As a trier, as a defense counsel, we're stating that the court should have allowed this evidence to come in some sort of way, the testimony, to have a fair and impartial trial, for this expert to testify in a certain way that would allow. Now, I'm bound by the way that the defense attorney said he wanted to testify, but the court, in its infinite wisdom, could have also taken the weight of what the court structured what it wasn't going to allow him to do. So the court could have then also said, I will allow him to educate me on what dissociative amnesia is related to PTSD, which everybody agrees is part of the record. It was established that this individual had a PTSD. It is also established by the record that the court did not have any prior knowledge or was familiar with dissociative amnesia. There's nothing to show that he did or did not, so we can infer that he did not.
I'll let you go well over. Can you wrap up for me?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. It's our position that the trial attorney should have been able to allow to call the expert witness to testify in that manner, and then the court could have given the proper weight due to the testimony of the defendant as well as to the expert. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Green. We will recounsel.